We're Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The Supreme Court's Harvest of Shame decision against farm workers and all who labor for better working conditions and the dignity their labor deserves.
Before we speak with Hugh Barron, staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, to understand how detrimental the recent Supreme Court decision is, let's listen to a clip from legendary journalist Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame, among the most famous television documentaries of all time. This acclaimed 1960 expose on the plight of migrant farm workers portrays brutally and honestly the working conditions, the living conditions that, as Morrow remarks, wrongs the very dignity of man. Those conditions continue for farm workers now.
This is a shape-up for migrant workers. The hawkers are chanting the going peace rate at the various fields. This is the way the humans who harvest the food for the best-fed people in the world get hired. One farmer looked at this and said, "We used to own our slaves. Now we just rent them." The Secretary of Labor looked at the migrant plight and said,
"I think they're the great mass of what I've called the excluded Americans. They are people who cry out, the workers and their children and their wives, who cry out for some assistance and whose plight is a shame. It's a shame in America."
The president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, the largest farmers organization, says,
"I think that most social workers would agree that it's better for a man to be employed, even if his capacity is such as to limit his income. And we take the position that it's far better to have thousands of these folks who are practically unemployable, earning some money, doing some productive work for at least a few days in the year."
This is an American story that begins in Florida and ends in New Jersey and New York State with the harvest. It is a 1960 Grapes of Wrath that begins at the Mexican border in California and ends in Oregon and Washington. It is the story of men and women and children who work 136 days of the year and average $900 a year. They travel in buses. They ride trucks. They follow the sun.
"Well, I don't know. It don't look like we'll ever get ahead. I guess we'll just have to keep going till we can find something better."
A minister named Cassidy, who works with them, says,
"They are just as bad as the slaves. Only on name they are not a slave, but in the way they are treated, they are worse than a slave. And somebody has to make thousands of dollars out of his sweat. Is that a slave or not?"
They are the migrants, workers in the sweatshops of the soil, the harvest of shame.
Now, Edward R. Murrow.
This is Harvest of Shame. It has to do with the men, women, and children who harvest the crops in this country of ours, the best-fed nation on earth. These are the forgotten people, the underprotected, the undereducated, the underclothed, the underfed. We present this report because, were it not for the labor of the people you are going to meet, you might not starve, but your table would not be laden with the luxuries that we have all come to regard as essentials. We should like you to meet some of your fellow citizens who harvest the food for the best-fed nation on earth.
Hugh Barron joins us to talk about the 6-3 vote along ideological lines of the Supreme Court, a harvest of shame that has gutted a California regulation enacted nearly 50 years ago after a campaign by famed union organizer Cesar Chavez to improve the lives of farm workers.
The Supreme Court just tightened the roadblocks to union representatives. and their ability to organize farm workers in California and across the country. Could you talk about who brought the challenge and the nature of the challenge to the California law that had allowed union organizers to enter farms, to speak to workers during non-working hours before and after work, as well as during lunch for a set number of days each year, which is limited in and of itself?
So I think it helps to first put the regulation at issue here in context. During the New Deal, farm workers were excluded from both the minimum wage protections of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the federal law that guarantees minimum wage and overtime protections to the nation's workers, as well as the union organizing rights under the National Labor Relations Act. These exclusions were absolutely and clearly racially motivated. Southern planters were fighting to preserve Jim Crow and keep Black workers destitute and disempowered, as well as Latinos and other workers of color, who at that point in time, Black workers in particular in the South were the majority of the agricultural workforce. So to this day, the National Labor Relations Act still excludes farm workers from its protections, and farm workers still do not enjoy the full wage and hour protections of federal law, particularly overtime protections. In the 1960s in California, waves of migration from Mexico and Asia, as well as terrible working conditions on farms across the state, helped fuel a powerful movement among farm workers, which ultimately became the United Farm Workers Union. Workers joined together and fought for years to not only win wage increases and other workplace protections, like health and safety protections, and to win the right to unionize so that they could have a say in the conditions of their work. There were violent clashes at times between growers and who were determined to break the power of workers and their unions. Sheriff's deputies were mobilized as well. There were arrests, injuries, and even deaths. And ultimately, the workers succeeded in winning passage of the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act in 1975. That created an agency called the Agricultural Labor Relations Board that was designed to create labor peace and guarantee justice for workers and stability in labor relations by safeguarding workers' rights to join and form unions and collectively bargain free from employer intimidation. Shortly after that, that board enacted a regulation because they determined that it was important for farm workers who were largely migratory in the sense that they were migrants from other countries and that they were migratory within the state of California, that it was necessary to ensure that they could receive basic information about their rights as workers, including the rights to unionize. And the board found that the migratory nature of farm workers impeded effective communication outside the workplace. Workers would move into a town for a harvest. They lived in motels, labor camps, or with friends, and they would move out to follow the next crop. So the board found that it was necessary to ensure that organizers could directly talk to workers during certain limited non-working hours, so 60 minutes before and after work and during lunch for a total of 3 hours a day, up to 120 days a year. So that was what the regulation did. It allows organizers to make an application with notice to the employer to go on to the worksite, talk in this very limited period of time to workers about their union rights.
He said they have to make an application. As another caveat here, they not only have to make an application, but I assume when one does that, that it can also be denied. So there are already these incredible limitations.
That's right. And there's also other limitations as well. So organizers can't interfere. Right? So that's one. The employer can challenge the access. When organizers come onto the property, they can't interfere with work operations. They can't talk to anybody during work time either. And so in reality, the union actually, the UFW, only seeks these rights for a period of 30 days, typically. And really, the whole 3 hours a day is kind of not true, because in practice, workers are rarely accessible before or after work for reasons I think we could all relate to, right? When you're going into your job, you're not particularly inclined to talk to somebody. You're just trying to get to work. So in reality, most of this access is limited to lunch breaks, about 30 minutes a day.
If you could just now take us to the point of who were the agricultural producers who actually brought this challenge, and what do we know of them?
So back in 1976, growers brought challenges like this one to the access regulation. The California Supreme Court rejected those challenges. They found it was that the regulation was not a taking, and they then after there was an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which was dismissed by the Supreme Court because it didn't raise what was considered a substantial federal question, meaning the court didn't see it as raising any issue of significant federal constitutional law at all. Then, more recently, in the last few years, this challenge was brought by two growers. Important to be clear what they were after, right? They didn't seek damages. They didn't seek money or compensation, which is what the Fifth Amendment requires, right? The Fifth Amendment says when the government takes private property, it needs to provide just compensation. They didn't seek compensation. They sought declaratory and injunctive relief to stop the regulation from being used. They did that because they want to deprive their workers of union rights, period, because they know that union organizers' ability to speak to farm workers at the work site on their lunch break is one of the only ways farm workers can learn of their rights to organize and meaningfully improve their conditions. Also important to look at who else was behind this lawsuit. This wasn't just two farms that one day decided to bring this challenge. This was a coordinated legal attack on the regulation that has much broader implications. Just like in the union busting Janus case, a web of dark money corporate interests fueled this case. If you look at, there's an amicus brief from Senator Whitehouse and other senators. 11 of the friends of the court who filed briefs to support the plaintiffs in this case were funded by a specific set of industry-tied foundations and dark money groups, like the Koch Foundation and the Bradley Foundation and Donors Trust. And as in the Janus case, these interests heavily invested in their desired outcome, which is not only to break the power of unions, which is one of their big goals, but also to more broadly dismantle the state's ability to regulate corporate conduct for the public good.
Since we are by and large, either there are those of us in urban areas or otherwise, we are kept distant from farm workers and the kind of conditions and circumstances of their lives. So in terms of the facts on the ground, what does it actually mean? Who are they? What are their living conditions so that it impacts on their final work conditions and the terms and conditions of their work to keep these organizers away from them?
So the problem is that agricultural working conditions are very different from, you know, what we think of as often, you know, an office employer or a factory in terms of access. There are no public areas for organizers to meet with workers outside of these fields. Generally, where public highways end, growers' land begins. So there's, you know, trying to pamphlet someone or have a conversation with someone on a sidewalk or a parking lot, there are none. Right, workers depend on labor contractors to transport them to and from the fields in buses. They don't stop when they're entering the field so that they can talk to people outside the workplace. There is no public transportation to most farms. There are no off-site lunchrooms or cafeterias. Workers take their breaks and eat their lunches on fields, right, at the edges of the field, or on the buses that were brought in that are used to bring them in and out. That's generally what happens. And I think your question beyond just sort of the access issues is really like, what are farm worker conditions in this country today? They are still very, very harsh working conditions. Farm workers typically, the average total family income ranges from $17,500 to $20,000. There are very few safety nets for farm workers who lose their jobs if they are retaliated against among by their employers. In addition, you know, farm work is very difficult, physically demanding work. And because there are no overtime requirements, there are no overtime protections under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, across the country, growers continue to impose long hours, unsafe conditions, and low pay on farm workers. In particular, farm workers labor in conditions that expose them to extreme temperatures, require them to work with heavy machinery and carry really heavy loads, and that also expose them to dangerous chemicals and pesticides. And so this puts a real toll on farm workers' bodies and lives. And one of the reasons that union rights are so important is because they can actually address these conditions and ameliorate them.
Now, the Supreme Court decision strikes down the California law, but the justification is that this is a taking of property without due process. Constitutional requirement is a due process without compensation. This isn't mentioned in the decision or in the lawsuit. Could you comment on that and whether this leaves an opening for an appeal?
Yes, I think this is a very important point that, you know, even though the court has found that this is a taking, despite the fact that that holding flies in the face of all of its former precedents, that there is actually a path forward, which is just compensation. Essentially, the government needs to pay for the access if it wants to provide, continue to provide unions with that access. So the question is, how much is that worth, right, in this case? Even some of the members of the majority of the court acknowledged that probably this was not going to amount to very much money. And Nathan Newman, writing in The Week, talked about the idea that this could actually be, you know, the payment for this could be covered even by a tax. So if the government has to make this just compensation, it can also require employers to pay a tax as part of the right to be able to do this kind of work and have and to be in the marketplace for farm work. So, you know, there are potentially there are workarounds here that could exist. And I expect, particularly in progressive states, Democratic states, that there will be an effort to try to make such workarounds. But I think the problem is that every kind of regulation that could be reframed as a taking of property under this new standard then has to be rethought and retooled. And I think that the dissent is right that this is going to become unworkable because there are many local, state, and federal laws and regulations that permit the government or third parties to come onto property to conduct health and safety inspections, environmental inspections, food safety inspections, and now the government has to pay for that. That just, you know, I think it flies in the face of common sense to most people, and it also just doesn't accord with the court's precedents, which have held that when you open your business up to the public, when you open your property up for commercial use, you're subject to reasonable regulations of that use and how it affects the public.
I think the question is the cause of action and understanding this and what it means for other labor decisions, et cetera, from the court. So if you could just talk a little bit more about what it means to say taking without, we're talking about organizing. What really was the issue that we need to understand and how do you think it influences future decisions about labor organizing, because after all, the Supreme Court sets precedent for future activity.
So the Fifth Amendment generally prohibits the government from taking private property without just compensation. I think we all, you know, sort of intuitively would understand certain actions to be a taking. So for example, eminent domain is a classic example when the government takes certain property to turn it into something new or redevelop it in some kind of way for the public, like for a highway or for whatever other beneficial use that the government thinks exists. We understand that when the government does that, when it takes someone's private property in that way completely and totally and does something else with it, they have to pay for that. But then there's another category of what the Supreme Court has considered to be takings, and these are regulatory takings, where regulations somehow affect property owners' interests in their property. Under the doctrines of the Supreme Court before Wednesday, regulations were only interpreted as per se takings, which mean that they are on their face taking, when they totally deprive a landowner of all viable economic use of their property, or when they represent some kind of permanent physical occupation of the property. Here, the court has done something radical and new. Despite dressing it up as a technical dispute with no real-world implications, that's very within their precedents, it's actually taken a sharp turn, because it is said that a regulation like the one here that allows limited restriction of on one part of property rights, right? What the right to exclude others from your land. The court has said that that constitutes a per se taking. It is a taking on its face that needs to be compensated. And so that is a sharp departure from the court's precedents and really puts a host of regulations in jeopardy. It also potentially puts anti-discrimination laws in jeopardy, because there are anti-discrimination laws are limitations on who an employer, business or a business can exclude from their property. It was long recognized since the Supreme Court's decision in the Heart of Atlanta Motel case that those laws were not takings. All of that's now up for new debate and for reconsideration after this ruling.
So to what extent does this open up the field for other challenges with regard to, for instance, federal regulation of employers with regard to health and safety violations and things of that nature?
It absolutely opens all of that up to challenges, because there are many local, state, and federal laws and regulations that permit the government or third parties to come onto property in time-limited ways for health and safety inspections, environmental inspections, food safety inspections. Many of those laws let non-government parties come onto property along with government regulators. And under this decision, all of that may be subject to review under the new test set out by this majority. And, you know, the majority has sort of said, well, like, that's not really going to happen. There are all these exceptions. There's exceptions for what were understood to be background limitations on property rights, and we all know what those are. But I think the dissent is correct that those exceptions are not actually workable, and those are just sort of a matter of convenience and the majority explaining away the radical nature of the decision it has imposed on all of us. In reality, a wide range of laws and regulations that benefit workers, consumers, and the public could be on the chopping block. The way that this case was brought to the court, the plaintiffs, the growers, did everything they could to lose in the lower courts. They didn't develop facts, so there was no factual record for the court to look at about what the regulations really did. They didn't even try to apply the court's pre-existing regulatory takings doctrine. They just wanted to lose their case so they could get it in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the U.S. Supreme Court could radically change the takings law. As a democracy, we should be concerned that people can so radically alter our constitutional framework without having actual cases and controversies, which is what the Constitution requires when our federal courts take cases, not made-up controversies. Here, the growers didn't even allege any damages. They didn't allege any actual harm to them. It was just this abstract taking of their right to exclude. And I think we should be very troubled by this and the democratic implications of this decision.
Is there any state laws that provide any kind of workaround of those, anything that's been described within the Supreme Court decision that gives any opportunity for a kind of workaround to organize people at the seat of their employment?
For farm workers, yes, there are workarounds in states that have developed, the, you know, like California and New York, you know, their own union organizing frameworks for farm workers who remain excluded from the federal union organizing law. There's going to be different experiments with those workarounds, but essentially it boils down to a need to compensate employers if such access is taken. And the question is, how will governments pay for that compensation, and how much will that compensation be determined to be? It may be, you know, in this case, that it's like a dollar a day for every time that access is taken. That would not be a, that would be a very small amount. The question is whether courts will ultimately value, with greater factual development, if they will value the access that way, or if they will go in some other direction, and particularly given the sweeping change in the judiciary that President Trump enacted through his appointments to the court of really deeply conservative judges across the country, it's hard to know and hard to predict exactly how that will play out. There is reason to be hopeful that this alternative approach could work. Certainly, the Agricultural Labor Relations Board in California released a strong statement in reaction to the decision that said they are committed to developing a process that both satisfies the requirements of the Cedar Point Nursery decision and continues to protect farm worker rights. So for farm workers, I think in states that have developed these kinds of union organizing regimes for farm workers, there are ways forward. I also think that the movement that farm workers built in the 60s continues to this day, and it's not going to be stopped by one Supreme Court decision. This isn't going to stop farm workers from organizing to improve their working conditions, because farm workers continue to be underpaid and overworked, and because they know that joining together in a union is the most effective way to challenge the harsh conditions that are imposed by large farm corporations.
Those of us who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes, and neither will the farm workers in their efforts for equal rights and justice for the terms and conditions of their incredible labor. This almost takes me back to Edward R. Murrow's, "The farmers feed the nation and have some of the worst, most abysmal conditions." I want to thank you for imparting this terrific and painful analysis of what the Supreme Court did, but reminding us that it's still about organizing to be able to unionize and to support just and fair rights for the laborers of this country.
It really is one of the most radical and dangerous decisions from this court, and it hasn't gotten enough attention. So thank you for taking the time to focus on it and its implications.
Thank you. Hugh Barron with the National Employment Law Project, thanks for your forensic analysis of the Supreme Court's Harvest of Shame decision.
Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.